Call the Military and Veterans Affairs meeting to order, and here at North Star Hospital is hosting us. Let the record reflect that it's 9:39 on Tuesday, July 28, 2015. Welcome to the House Special Committee on Military and Veterans Affairs. Present Representative Culver, my Vice Chair, Representative Ledoux, Representative Hughes, and myself, Chair Herron, with Representative Tuck joining us as well. Good morning.
Good morning.
Today we're going to have invited testimony only on post-traumatic stress disorder and substance abuse and dependence treatment for veterans. It is presenters will we have a list here that will come forward, and then at following this there will be an event celebrating the opening of the Chris Kyle Patriots Hospital on McGraw today at 11:30. And but this morning here we'd like to give our speakers an opportunity to testify. When you're speaking, please put yourself on the record, identify yourself, and your affiliation. So without further ado, we'd like to ask Dr. Debbie Gurris and Dr. Michael Alcorn, staff psychiatrists for the military program, to please come forward. Good morning. Again, please put yourself on the record, your name and affiliation, and begin your testimony, please. Thank you.
I'm Dr. Deborah Burris. I'm a staff psychiatrist here at North Star Hospital.
Probably have to, for the record, because we have people online, speak directly into it.
Yes. So good morning, Chairman, committee members. I'm Dr. Deborah Burris. Good morning, Chairman, committee members. I'm Dr. Deborah Burris. One of the staff psychiatrists here at North Star Hospital, and I've been working with our military veterans program since it opened in April. And I just wanted to give you a brief overview of substance abuse disorders and our approach to treatment here at our new program. So, substance use disorders involve 10 separate classes of drugs. I won't list them all, but the primary offenders were all familiar with alcohol, stimulants, opioids, and inhalants, or the patients here in the physical access. They all have a common that they activate the brain's reward system, and when they are taken in excess, this activation, this repeated activation of the reward system leads to reinforcement of behaviors associated with use of the substance, many of which are not adaptive, and leads to intense craving experienced by the individual when exposed to the environment in which the substance is used, and continued use of the substance despite any consequences. So we diagnose substance use disorder based on the maladaptive pattern of behavior associated with their use. So the behaviors can be classified into basically three major categories. The first is impaired control. So what we notice is that patients start to use the drug in larger amounts and over a greater period of time than they originally intended. They report repeated attempts to cut down or discontinue use without success. And they spend more time either trying to attend the question, use it, or recover from it. And again, they usually experience intense craving when exposed to the environment in which the substance is used or abused. And that contributes to relapse rates. The second category is the category of social impairment. So when individuals develop a substance use disorder, generally we see that they over time fail to provide major role obligations in their family, at work, in the community. They continue to use despite negative consequences in those areas. And over time, they start to ignore recreational activities, family obligations, work obligations altogether. This is a And then the last category is my business, so what we see is that over time, people repeatedly put themselves in higher risk situations in order to obtain or use the substance in question, and continue to use the substance despite the fact that they experience some psychological impairment from the drug. It might be a mood disorder, it might be repeated intoxication, withdrawal, liver impairment. There's a number of them, but people will continue to use the drug despite the So with most drugs, people develop what we call tolerance, it's a normal physiological response. Over time, individuals require a larger amount of drugs to achieve the desired effect. And then with most substances, not all, individuals can develop a withdrawal syndrome when they decrease their use of the drug after they've been using it for a long time. And in the case of alcohol, for example, the withdrawal syndrome that's precipitated by discontinuing use can be dangerous and life-threatening. So there's a very high prevalence of substance use disorder. My interest in this, in treating this disorder, is that it can really affect anyone in any walk of life. And so I find that my patients are all very interesting. They come from every walk of life, and I enjoy getting to know them. We do see higher rates of substance use disorder in young males, between the ages of 18 and 29%. And for alcohol in particular, we see higher rates of substance use disorders here in the state. So we also see high comorbidity of substance use disorders with pre-existing mood disorders or impairments in impulse control and executive function. And then what we found is that substances can also cause mood disorders, and prolonged use can lead to some neurocognitive impairment. So when a patient comes into our program, we provide a thorough assessment to identify the nature of the substance use disorder, the nature of the substance's abuse, the degree of impairment and substance use disorder. We do our best to identify any co-occurring disorder that might be either pre-existing or induced by the use of the substance. That's done by the psychiatrist on staff. If necessary, we perform neuropsychological testing as well, but to better clarify the diagnosis. We focus on the prevention and treatment of withdrawal symptoms to maintain safety. And then I would say that we very carefully use medications when they are appropriate to address any co-occurring mood disorders and to offer medications that might help the patient maintain sobriety. And then in individual and group psychotherapy, we focus on education to help patients learn about the substance use disorder that they suffer from, help them understand co-occurring disorders, understand their triggers, and to develop coping skills for dealing with strong emotions, triggers, and relapses. And then finally, we do our best to help our patients out with resources back on day for the community.
I guess the question that I would have, and I'll open it up to committee, is do combat victims of PTSD, are they at higher risk? Of course, there is post-traumatic events that happen in people's lives that's not related to combat. Mm-hmm. Is there some comparison there?
So I can't tell you the exact percentage of trauma victims that would go on to develop a substance use disorder, specifically combat trauma victims, but certainly any history of trauma is a risk factor in general. It leads to some obvious difficulty regulating emotions. People often turn to substance to try to do that. So I
would agree with your question. Okay. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
We've got two questions. Go ahead. Representative Ledoux.
But if you can't tell us the percentage of
post-traumatic stress disorder soldiers or airmen who have substance abuse problems versus the general population? There are no statistics.
I personally can't answer that question, but maybe one of our other guests here this morning might know that specific.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The I understand that some of the substance use disorders could lead to mood disorders, but is the opposite true as well, that mood disorders could also lead to substance use disorders?
So what we know is that they often co-occur. So when we talk about mood use disorder, we know that depression such as alcohol, sedatives, and anxiolytics while initiating intoxication often leads to depressed mood, and over time can lead to depressed mood that resolves when the patient discontinues use, usually for about 4 to 6 weeks. So we don't know that mood disorder leads to depression. We don't know that there's a cause and effect, but we do know that there's a high rate of occurrence.
Thank you.
Okay, well, one more question from Representative Hughes, then we'll go to Dr. Alcorn.
Thank you for being here this morning. Suicide has been a very prevalent stat here in our state. Are we seeing higher rates of suicide associated with those substance abuse in Alaska as opposed to other places in the nation among the military?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Alcorn, if you could put yourself on the record and your affiliation, please.
Good morning, Chairman Herron and representatives. Thank you for letting me come and speak with you this morning. I talked to you a little bit about PTSD. I'm Dr. Alcorn. I'm an Air Force psychiatrist and just discharged from the military last Tuesday. And so I have been working quite a bit with the active duty military population. I was on active duty for 7 years, and prior to that, a large part of my training was done at a VA hospital. So I kind of went in the reverse order and I worked a lot with veterans with PTSD and substance abuse issues during the first part of my work as a psychiatrist. As you probably are all aware, PTSD and traumatic brain injury have kind of been the cardinal injury of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. I looked up some statistics just to kind of give you an idea of what we've seen over the last 10 to 15 years. But from 2004 through 2012, the rate of PTSD in military retirees rose from 4 to 20%. So we're talking about fivefold. Along those lines, from 2003 to 2013, the number of service-connected disability cases for PTSD rose from 196,000 to a little over 653,000, so about a threefold increase. And just overall, PTSD is the third most common disability amongst military retirees following just hearing loss and tinnitus or ringing in the ears. Kind of mirroring the number and the increase overall of the PTSD cases. PTSD hospitalizations from, I believe it was 2006 to 2012, increased by 192%. And so definitely PTSD is kind of one of the conditions that is requiring a lot of treatment and thus requires a lot of extension. So I just wanted to kind of introduce you to a little bit of kind of what we deal with when we're dealing with PTSD. Kind of in my time working with patients with post-traumatic stress disorder, one of the things that has kind of stood out and when I try and train medical students or psychiatry residents, one of the things I talk to them about is how it is a very kind of diverse condition. There's no kind of stereotypical PTSD patients. The way the diagnosis is made is there are basically 20 symptoms amongst four different kind of categories, and you basically have to have a combination of six of the 20 symptoms. So somebody who's more mathematically inclined than I am calculated there's basically over 636,000 combinations of symptoms that can make the diagnosis for a given patient. So because of that, I kind of tell the people I'm training, PTSD should always be on your differential diagnosis, partly because trauma just in general is so high, even in the general population. Not everybody who's traumatized develops PTSD. Some studies would suggest maybe a quarter to a third of people who are exposed to a trauma will actually develop PTSD. But again, the rates are so high that I kind of teach people that I'm trained that any mental health evaluation you do, and really anybody that you see in a medical setting, you should kind of screen for not only exposure to trauma, but PTSD. You know, patients can come in and ultimately having a PTSD diagnosis, and when they come in, they can look like they're very depressed. They can look like they're very anxious. If they're, you know, preoccupied a lot of the time with these intrusive thoughts of their trauma or things, they may look like they have concentration problems, ADHD. Of course, a lot of times, and Dr. Gerst talked about this, but a lot of times before they come to our clinic or come to us for help, they've developed substance abuse issues. And so really, no matter what they come in with, it's something that we always are kind of looking to see if this is the case. Just like the symptoms that they're dealing with are very diverse. Every patient that has PTSD can kind of take their own course. Some patients will develop kind of their first symptom flare shortly after their exposure to the trauma, but there are definitely other times where they can go years, even decades without their first symptom flare. Likewise, some patients are very sensitive, and anything that's psychologically stressful can potentially cause their symptoms to start to flare on them, whereas for other patients, they really need some specific reminder of their trauma, whether it's a smell or a sound or a place. And so this kind of plays into treatment, because when it comes to kind of designing a treatment plan, thinking about, you know, can they do outpatient treatment, inpatient, what do they need? You kind of have to meet the patient where they're at. Some patients, when they come in, they're ready to kind of get whatever happened or what they've experienced off their chest. They're ready to kind of form that therapeutic relationship. They're ready to talk. In those cases, maybe outpatient therapy has a pretty good chance to succeed. You know, they can come in once a week, even once every other week, and they can process their trauma. But you'll see other people that come in, and they basically have tried their hardest to avoid thinking about or talking about whatever it was that they experienced. And so for those individuals, you know, sometimes outpatient doesn't work because they cannot get comfortable, especially when they're only seeing their therapist once a week, once every other week. It's not enough. They can't develop a level of trust. They can't bring themselves to really reveal these things that they've experienced. Sometimes with PTSD, there's a lot of shame and guilt that goes along with it. And so one of the things we look at sometimes in deciding who they need to be in a residential treatment program is, do they need a more intensive program where maybe they can see their therapist every day or every other day and really kind of break through that feeling of mistrust and form that relationship and then progress with their treatment. One thing I like about the program and the way it's structured and it's consistent with some of the evidence base is that the first phase of the program is kind of working with the patients on kind of developing their coping skills, working on just kind of making sure that they're comfortable, that there's that level of trust before they are kind of pushed into the next phase of starting to address their trauma and work through that. So again, some patients do fine without outpatient. Some patients are pretty good in outpatients and only need to go to like a short-term inpatient hospital. You know, if there's a short-term crisis, something happens, they go into the hospital for a few days, things get resolved, and they can go back home. But there are those patients who need a longer-term treatment. So the things that I see as a benefit of having a program here in Alaska over the last 5 to 7 years of working with the military, we've sent a large number of patients from the clinic on base down to the lower 48 for residential treatment, either for PTSD, for substance abuse, or for a treatment of both. And some of the patients have done fine doing that, but there are definitely challenges with that. One of the biggest challenges I see is it's very hard to provide family therapy and services to the people that are going to be supportive of the patient when they return to their home. You know, some of the programs have tried to do teleconferencing or things like that, but it's just not the same. And what I've frequently seen in the outpatient clinic is the patients come back from the lower 48 the first time or two we came in the clinic, they do look improved, but rapidly thereafter, problems at home, problems at work continue just like they were before they went to treatment, and that just kind of triggers and leads to an increase in their symptoms. So one thing I try to do in the outpatients and one thing that we're trying to incorporate here in the program is the family therapy component. I always try and talk to the spouse or significant other or whoever the patient identifies as kind of their trusted figure, provide psychoeducation, make sure they have at least an elementary understanding of PTSD, and hopefully can start to understand why the patient experiences some of the things that they do. And then talk about things that they can do or hopefully how we're changing at home or at work that can make things a little better, a little more tolerable for the patient when they return to those settings. Of course, having a local program is also very beneficial when it comes to cost. I'm not sure about how the veterans do it, but I know for the active duty military, usually when we would send a patient to the lower 48, it would not only be a round-trip ticket for that patient, but usually an escort would go along to make sure that the patient would get there, make sure that the patient would get back, which adds to the cost, and that was always something that working with the units, they would always kind of ask about whether they really have to go down there with their cell here in Anchorage or in Alaska, a little closer that we could do that. And I know when I was leaving the base, they were very with the program here was opening. And then again, the dual diagnosis, the ability to treat both substance abuse and PTSD under the same roof is very important. Because again, a lot of the patients with PTSD, they really look for any ways that they can to make their symptoms more tolerable. And so if you do have a patient with a substance abuse problem, trying to get them to fully engage in PTSD treatment, therapy, to go through kind of the difficulties of facing their trauma just becomes that much more difficult. And so I do believe you have to kind of treat both at the same time. Trying to do it sequentially, it obviously takes longer and it's not as effective. So that concludes the things I wanted to kind of talk to you about. Any questions?
Yes, we do have one question. Of course, we got a long agenda here, so we'll have to move along.
It seems like there's been a huge increase in the number of diagnosed PTSD cases. So I'm wondering whether or not that is because there's actually more PTSD than those increased numbers, or whether it has something to do with the focus on PTSD and the diagnosis of PTSD. The cases that may be diagnosed now as PTSD may not have been diagnosed previously.
So I do believe that there's a combination of things that play into the increase in the PTSD. Obviously, PTSD is a relatively new diagnosis. You know, in the old days, it was called shell shock. And then at one point in time, a lot of patients who now would be diagnosed with PTSD were diagnosed with things including schizophrenia. So there is definitely greater awareness of PTSD. I think with regard to the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, I do believe advances in battlefield medicine, advances in technology have allowed a lot of military members to live through wounds that previously they would not have. And while that's a good thing, obviously, again, the psychological trauma becomes more prominent, especially later in life. In the military, obviously, one thing we always deal with is this a legitimate diagnosis? Are they trying to mimic what their buddies have said, or are they, you know, trying to game the system? The good thing with PTSD is there are different psychological tests and objective measures that you can use, and obviously the more collateral information you can get, the more helpful it is. But I think it's a combination of all those things. I don't think you can just say this is the reason why there's more PTSD now.
Okay, we'll have a follow-up, and then we'll ask Andy to come up.
There has to be a physical injury in order to have PTSD, especially observing something can trigger it.
That's a very good question. It's something that has been debated at times, especially there was a new diagnostic manual that came out recently. It can be something that was observed or witnessed, or even technically if you have repeatedly heard about it. For instance, now in the latest diagnostic manual, even first aid medical professionals and things like that, who repeatedly hear the same traumatizing story, if their response at the time of observing or witnessing it kind of indicates that they are being significantly affected and they go on to present the later symptoms, they can be diagnosed with it. Personally, I'd say it's fairly rare that I've ever diagnosed it as somebody who hasn't in some way experienced it directed towards themselves. Maybe they don't have the actual physical injury, although, you know, maybe a munition landed, you know, 5 feet away from them and didn't explode, and so they were assuming that they were going to be killed. So I think it's rare that, you know, somebody has seen something on TV or heard something and I've given a diagnosis.
I appreciate it, doctors, for your testimony, and we're going to ask Andy Lanning to come up, and we'll move on to the next presenter. Appreciate it. Thank you very much. Sir, if you could put yourself on the record and your affiliation and begin with your testimony.
Yes, sir. Good morning. Yes, I'm Andy Lanning. I'm the Division Director of Military Programs at University Health Services, and one of the hospitals that falls under our command, if you will, is with that, we have over 27 med-surg facilities across the country, and over 220 behavioral health facilities across the country, including Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands, and England. So it's a very large continuum of care, emotional behavior health. Within that piece, tied in is we have a program called the Patriot Support Program. Almost 80% of our facilities are affiliated with Vicarious Practice Certified, if you will. So we see folks from geriatrics to down to 4 years old, so a huge continuum of care. The Patriot Support Program is focused on veterans and active duty and service members. There are 14 facilities out of all of those that have dedicated programs, which are going to be like the Chris Kyle program that we're opening up here, that actually has a dedicated treatment program for active duty members and veterans. Family members are not in it. What we found at the height of the wars, and I should have mentioned I'm retired, a 30-year veteran from the Air Force in St. Clair myself, we found was they reacted better to treatment when they're in groups together. As we start going through some of the trauma cases, the combat trauma, and some of the stresses of military life, when we were in the population of treatment with the civilian folks, we were traumatized a lot of the people. And they felt better cross bond with their brothers and sisters. So that was the premium to doing these facilities. So we do a lot with obviously substance abuse, combat trauma, trauma in any case, a lot more, we see a lot more military sexual trauma for females and for men. It's not just the females. In addition to that, this past year, we have 13 other facilities we call our Patriot Support Service Centers that have programs that we treat now with each other all the time, following our core standards that we established, following our best practices, and repeated visits to facilities to ensure that the core integrity of the programs there, I'll mention that in a minute. Although, but those programs are, the pages are intermixed with civilian population. Some of the installations are very comfortable with that. They may be folks being mentored out, and having an integration in with the civilian population is actually beneficial to them to kind of learn some of that social stuff to reintegrate back into civilian life after you've been in just with the military folks with that. Now, one of those things, we also have a military advisory board, which Evan McDaniels is here with us today, with seven officers, five that were general officers, and I'll leave that to him to explain that piece. We have a military consultant, Dr. Harry Schultz, retired general, psychiatrist that visits our facilities, but we do one of those 14 facilities. Looking at the clinical integrity of the program, ensuring it's solid. And then personally, I spent a lot of time in facilities working with them on communication, very deep, obviously. Communication, understanding military culture, and providing training to doctors and staff that have not been in the military, not experienced that, how that culture is. So when these men and women come in and command comes in, they have a better understanding of what that is. So it just helps a lot understanding that.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Any questions for Andy? Well, I appreciate you testifying, and especially the services that UHS provides for our veterans. Thank you very much. Next on our list is Admiral William McDaniels. Sir, if you could come forward, put yourself on the record and your affiliation, and begin your testimony.
My name is Bill McDaniels. I'm a retired veteran of the United States Navy Armed Physicians, and I'm on the board of advisors for the Patriot Support Program for UHS. I'd like to address something that Andy just mentioned, and briefly that about a while ago, that the incident increased. There's many ways we treat this, obviously. One of the principal ways is basically getting groups together, getting people to start thinning. Eventually, they talk it out, and this is all involved in this 28-day program amongst many of the other modalities. That turned out to be phenomenally effective. Why do you see a lot of this stuff out of France after the Second World War? How do you get home after the Second World War? You had 3 weeks on a cruise ship with 5,000 of your buddies, all of them went on the same trauma you did. What he had to do, he had nothing to do with talk. And they really provided their own therapy extremely well. Now, they were other internal kind of problems. But in fact, we think one of the reasons that we didn't have any more diagnosable cases at the time of the report as compared to now is what happens now. 18 hours after you almost get blown up, you're back at Walgreens or Bethesda or someplace. You're back with your family. You have no chance to be depressed. You have no chance to compare experiences with your friends. And you have no chance to talk it out. That's part of what led to this is our incredibly rapid travel in addition to rapid diagnosis and safety programs. I love the history of this disease because it's a fascinating history. Our board consists, as Andy mentioned, of three three-star admirals and generals from the Army, Navy, and Air Force. We have two 2-stars, 1-star, and 9-star. What we all had in common, we've all been in combat. I was Vietnam, most of us were Vietnam. We have all dealt with this condition, amongst many others, all our professional lives. We all, upon retirement, continue to have that desire to make sure that we can still give the best treatment possible to those people who were once under our care and still are in our memories and care. We have many opportunities as flight officers to serve on various committees and have everybody wants it. Just because it looks nice. And so we have to pick and choose. We very carefully looked around and looked at systems trying to build a group of us. Actually, all know each other very, very well. We served together on a number of committees. And when we were approached by UHS, asking we would be interested in getting involved in this endeavor with them, we looked very carefully at Harry Phillips, who is our senior psychiatrist in our group, and went out and looked around at all the programs. And we realized that their lives are for the nation. So we are better off to stay involved with this group because that is what they do. We all have to wrap that up. We have a lot of talk. I'm an orthopedic surgeon. I give actually a fair number of talks on post-traumatic stress syndrome. I usually have a compassion and what in the world is an orthopedic giving us a talk, and that's a very good question, but I'm still asking to do that.
So, Admiral, this is a nice segue here, is I'm going to ask my vice chair to ask you a question. But in the answer to that question, who is UHS? I mean, why did you affiliate yourself with them? So, Representative Ledoux, your question?
Well, I was just wondering if you've seen a big change and an increase in post-traumatic stress because people go from a battle zone to back to the States in just a brief period of time, instead of being on a carrier for 18 days, having a chance to decompress with their friends, their buddies, etc. Why not go back to a carrier system? I'm serious. To get them back to the States, or if not a carrier, have some sort of, instead of, you know, bringing them home and saying, hey, you know, you're on leave, have some sort of camp or something for them to decompress.
That's a great question, and believe me, we have debated that a lot. The answer is very political. These people have been gone 6 months to a year. They definitely want to get home to their family. So the first thing they're going to do, if they know that they show signs and symptoms of PTSD, if they know that you're not holding something for 3 weeks so you can actually try to expect some treatment, I guarantee they will show no signs and symptoms. And so then you're all trying to just be hold everybody. Well, you're running into a political windstorm there that none of us can survive, and that is, tell them folks when they come out of the war zone and sorry, you can't see your family for another 3 weeks, we're up home just in case, would never work. I mean, believe me, that very idea has been broached and discussed and has been disregarded. It's absolutely politically impossible to do. So what we do is really we're trying all kinds of modalities to identify those people on the battlefield, and we're using both blood tests, and we're using behavioral tests, and they're having behavioral tests before they go, and in the internet monitor there, and before they come back. And then do as close as possible as humanly possible. We still know. But people will hide. They may not, they think there's any chance that an answer they give is going to delay their repatriation to their family and their friends. You're not going to get the credit. So that's a great question and something we've discussed at great length. Why in India? There's a number of groups around the country. We were approached by several advocates who wanted to be involved in rising the board. We looked at their programs, we looked at their approach. We think there's a huge, extremely essential thing you've got to have. One, you need to have the majority of your treated personnel be former military or associated with social military. They have to understand the culture. Some of the psychiatrists around you don't regard that. They think any general practice can do it. But we think the culture of having a military treated and military training programs is incredibly important. And two, you need to have a program set up so that it's really reflects the military. And again, we look at what they do here. What do you do here? You have a very rigorous program. You get up every morning, you have mandatory physical therapy every morning. A lot of them PT. You have twice a day. You have a regimen that's very akin to what they underwent in the military. That's what UHS does. And so if you can set your program up as closely as possible to what they are accustomed to in their normal daily life, you're going to get much better than UHS does. And that's the reason we chose to associate them.
So is UHS a governmental agency or is it a nonprofit? I'm just trying to get an idea of what exactly. I mean, universal health service, it sounds like the thing that the British have right now, or maybe a lot of it. But I mean, so I just actually don't know.
I'm sorry, no, it's just a private company that has a lot of it. And the gentleman who founded this company. He founded it 36 years ago. He's here at the town, and we'll be at the dedication this morning. And he believes very well. He really is very, very patriotic, and this is one of the things he believes in so well. It's the reason we're having this dedication today.
Thank you.
Representative Gibson.
Thank you, and thank you for your service for the fire and also for your service. I just want to make sure that we acknowledge and appreciate it so much to you. We heard a lot about the increases in that we're seeing in the different categories, whether it's active duty or even retiring, which I find fascinating, because that's the people Vietnam fire has increased. So they're managing it, I'm guessing, while we're working that helps them, the ones that retire and pay for services by going out and stopping. But the problem is, does the person, and maybe it's for you that matters to the submission, but does the person who's once identified, right, do they ever fully recover, or are they always going to need services and some level of service and sound like a lot of people are coming in the dollars or whether you expect that these people will need services throughout their lifetime to some degree?
Well, I think the two psychiatrists who were here to answer that are far more anxious than I am. But I will say, there are all kinds of grief issues. The vast majority of people function great throughout their life. They will have episodes. They may have nightmares. If they get stressed, they may be constantly quicker. But by and large, most of their life, they're unfunctional. Good on the successful, good family people. The vast majority of them are in that category. That's a very small minority that just simply cannot function. And it's usually easy. So, by the way, I gave a talk not long ago on this condition at a large retired special operating forces gathering down in Seattle. And I've given a talk in a room like this, there's 30 prisoners. And there's a folding wall here, and on the other side is the bar, and there's 200 of them there. They were treating themselves also. They, in fact, have a social Vietnam era because they learned to treat themselves. Successfully, I'm not going to say, but in fact, they belong in the country.
Any other questions for the admiral? Sir, I appreciate your testimony this morning.
Yes,
thank
sir.
You very much. So, two more individuals to testify together, Dr. Ann Hutchinson and Laura McKenzie, if you could please come forward. Please state your name and your affiliation for the record and then begin. Thank you.
My name is Laura McKenzie, I'm a social worker with the Alaska VA. I'm on the Addiction Treatment Program. Thank you for this opportunity to speak regarding chemical dependency issues pertaining to our active duty service members and veterans. My office is located at the Domiciliary, which provides residential treatment for homeless veterans, and I work with veterans who are both homeless and housed. As you have heard, we will hear from others today, comprehensive substance use treatment is greatly needed for these populations. For the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, there are an estimated 23.4 million veterans in the United States and about 2.2 million military service members. Within Alaska, there are 77,000 veterans and 25,000 active service members, with Alaska having the highest per capita numbers of veterans in the country. The demanding environment of military life and the experiences of combat during which many veterans experience psychological distress can be further complicated by substance abuse and related disorders. Many service members face critical issues such as trauma, suicide, homelessness, and or involvement with the criminal justice system. Approximately 18.5% of service members returning from Iraq or Afghanistan have post-traumatic stress disorder or depression, and 19.5% report experiencing traumatic brain injury during deployment. Between 2004 and 2006, 7.1% of U.S. veterans met the criteria for substance use disorder, and 70% of homeless veterans experienced substance use disorder. Studies show that a strong relationship between PTSD and substance abuse in both civilian and military populations exists for both men and women. More than 2 of 10 veterans with PTSD also have substance use disorder combat veterans with PTSD and alcohol problems can be binge drinkers. This is a show in conflict that members of combat life and the difficulty with the transition from the theater of war skills to civilian life. Almost one out of every two veterans seeking treatment for substance abuse disorder also have PTSD. In the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, about 1 in 10 returning soldiers seen in the VA have a problem with alcohol or drugs. The National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence has also stated that more women are serving in the military than any point in our history. The gender shift creates new challenges in identifying, treating, returning veterans with substance use disorders. Expanded access to education, counseling, treatment, peer and recovery support services designed to address the unique needs of military women are needed. Included in this need are services to address issues arising from being in a dominantly male environment where there may have been a heightened risk for sexual harassment and sexual assault. One statistic that came from the Institute of Medicine noted that military physicians wrote nearly 3.8 million prescriptions for pain medication in 2009, which is more than quadruple the number of new prescriptions written in 2001. Recent reports from the Alaska State Department of Epidemiology noted that from 2008 to 2012 in Alaska, total of 51 hospital admissions and 2.5 outpatient evaluations occurred for heroin poisoning. The rate of inpatient hospital discharges coded for heroin poisoning nearly doubled from 2.4 per 10,000 population in 2008 to 4.7 per 10,000 hospital population in 2012. And heroin-related inpatient and outpatient hospital costs exceeded $2 million. The area of opiate dependence is one that is growing more rapidly than treatment providers can address with our cloud resources. The current availability of treatment providers in Alaska is inadequate to try to meet those needs. Programs such as the Chris Kyle Teaching Hospital are truly needed and bring benefit to our community. Recent data compiled for their CON application notes that on average, over 250 service members and veterans are sent out of state for inpatient treatment each year. Alaska is in the top 10% of quantity per capita in alcohol sales, as well as the persons determined to be alcohol dependent. Alaska has alcohol dependence rate twice the national average, and our rate of alcohol-related death is 2.5 times higher than the national rate since 2000, and ranks in the top 10 of the nation for the number of people identified as drinkers. I'm currently working to obtain an accurate estimate on the number of Alaska veterans who are active users of VA services and also have a substance abuse background. I have been able to determine that there's over at least 500 identified individuals in the Madison Valley who meet that criteria. Our program at the VA provides services on an outpatient and a residential basis for veterans with substance use disorders. Within the addiction treatment program, we serve on average 300 veterans every year. We utilize a cognitive approach, a manualized program for rehabilitation. Motivational interviewing and motivational enhancement therapies are also provided. We're able to supplement treatments provided at the domiciliary and ACP, with those available at the Mobile VA clinic and also in the extension. However, residential treatment in Alaska is currently only available to veterans without housing, and so veterans do not classify as homeless after treatment in the United States. This is an increased cost for the VA, removes the veteran from the national support system, and prevents family participation during the treatment effort. The VA is working on addressing the disparity in the treatment continuum and remains grateful that an option for Chris Kyle Pediatric Hospital has been opened. Their services fill the much needed gap between imbalance and free treatment episodes in the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, or Providence Medical Center, and the residential treatment of the domiciliary. In addition, the open campus of the domiciliary presents challenges for veterans who are at risk for elopement, and thus be better suited as a Chris Kyle Patriots Hospital. We welcome the partnership in providing the best care for our veterans and active staff members. Additional treatment modalities and support from our community and legislature are still needed. We at the VA are exploring the potential of providing gender-specific substance abuse treatment and expanding our programs in some fair-based and mapping areas. Modalities such as telehealth are allowing us to reach farther in existing communities than before. We also support Housing First initiatives and welcome the additional housing opportunities provided by Safe Harbor here in Anchorage. With support from our community and legislators, we hope to continue our work in serving the veterans in Alaska. I appreciate the opportunity to provide that perspective, and I welcome any questions that you have for me.
Thank you. I think we'll just hold off on questions till Go ahead, please. State your name and your affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Chairman. I'm Dr. Ann Hutchinson. I'm a PTSD psychologist at the Department of Veterans Affairs in Alaska. I'm also the evidence-based psychotherapy coordinator and serving as interim acting chief psychologist. First off, I just wanted to say that the PTSD SUV psychologist is a position across all VAs. And one of the reasons that they created this position was to better serve the needs of our human diagnosis and veterans. We all know that on average, those that were diagnosed with PTSD, 70% of those also had an alcohol use disorder problem over the course of their life. And when we're looking at the OESOASOD veteran population, that's also paralleling that to the Vietnam veteran concept. So that was one of the main reasons why they developed this position. And so it better allows us to treat the dual diagnosis veterans that we're seeing coming out of active duty and coming into the VA system. The evidence-based psychotherapy coordinator position is also critical to the VA, and VA has that position as well. And that one is created in part to help us get clinicians to trainings that would better serve the treatment of the veterans. So for example, we'll have clinicians that will sign up to go to the cognitive processing therapy. This is a big gold standard of treatment for PTSD. And they'll go for about a 3-day training process. And then they'll come back to the Alaska VA and they'll implement that training, but they'll be working with a consultant for the next 6 months with in-depth training. So that allows them to be able to really get that training and get that treatment out to the veterans. We have been recently going over the data to see what the main diagnoses that were being treated by our clinicians were. And of course, as Dr. Elkhorn had said, PTSD is often within the top 3 diagnoses being treated. And I thought, you know, that's only going to be for our specialty mental health veterans, but it wasn't. It was across all levels of treatment. So what, in that instance, primary care. So we had social workers that are attached to our primary care team. And what that tells me is that we are doing a great job getting in there, identifying the PTSD that's going on, and being able to treat it very early through brief behavioral intervention. So once a veteran is seen in that level of care, they may move on to specialty mental health services. And that's where it's more my role with. And that would be where they probably get more intensive treatment for their PTSD. So that would typically include, we may offer a PTSD 101 class, and that is a one-time class and offered every week for a veteran and their family. Then they may be asked to go on to do a PTSD symptom management class, and that's an 8-week session class that identifies the different symptoms of PTSD and the practical skills that they can apply to that. We have a couple other groups that we often recommend that veterans attend as well. Cognitive processing therapy, as I mentioned, that's one of our gold standards of treatment with the VA. Veterans have provided wonderful feedback that that's been a helpful group. And then we also have a dual diagnosis treatment called acceptance and commitment-based therapy, another great therapy approach that helps veterans with PTSD. Individual therapy, good therapy is not going to be a good fit for a veteran. We will offer individual therapy as well. You may have to do both group therapy and individual therapy. And this individual therapy is, as I mentioned, one is the cognitive processing therapy. And the second one is the prolonged exposure therapy as well. These are both, again, gold standard treatments and well-researched, as well evidence that those do effectively treat veterans with PTSD. We also have the availability to send veterans to the lower 48 to American Lake, or Wyoming is another great state where they offer intensive residential treatment for our veterans, and then they would return if we would begin training them again in outpatient therapy. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? I guess before we conclude this hearing and then go to the other event, is so does the Veterans Administration embrace this private sector effort? I mean, is it you don't see it as competition, so to speak?
Mr. Chairman, no, we don't. We welcome any additional resources for our veterans. We recognize that the need is greater than what we can meet at this time. And so at the end of the day, if our veterans are getting good care, it really doesn't matter to us who's providing.
Representative Ledoux.
So how does this work with respect to the payment for these services? Does TRICARE pay for this, or does the Veterans Administration refer people to the private health sector, and then the Veterans Administration pays for it? I'm just trying to figure out, you know, follow the money, so to speak. Looks like somebody wants to answer this.
Finn, you'll have to come to the mic and put yourself back on the record.
This is Andy Lane with the paid support program. The VA's lot of money is still separate from TRICARE money. They're different colors of money, so it's not the same. So when the veteran comes in, it's paid for through Veterans Affairs, or a case like myself in HR, I still carry TRICARE Prime. So I could tap into my TRICARE piece of that. So it's a little mixed for that piece. But I was going to the VA for VA services, if you were calling me, you would pick that up. If I was there for hours, you would pick up that cost.
So that's what I'm trying to figure out. So the VA actually refers them when they don't think that the VA has the services in-house. The VA will refer to UHS or some sort of similar organization. And I'm seeing...
Rudy, if you could put yourself on the record.
Hi, I'm Bertie Mullen, the Director of Veterans Affairs for the State of Alaska. The way it works on the VA side is that the doctor would refer the patient to outpatient care, and it's paid for three different ways within the VA system. The VA would do direct payment to the facility that is providing the care to the veteran, or it would be done under the PC3 contract, which they have, which has a network of care there. Or they would use the Veterans Choice Program, which is available for the next 3 years, that would also pay for Medicare as well.
Follow up. So what's the Veterans Choice Program and what's the PC3 program?
Well, the Veterans Choice Program is a few months back, President Obama signed the Veterans Choice Act in 2014. And within that act, that allows veterans to choose health care two ways. First, on their own under the Veterans or the Choice 3040 program, or the Veterans First program, which is a referral process within the VA system, and that is utilized for non-critical care. What I mean by that is emergent and urgent care is provided under a different vehicle, which is direct purchase. So that's that program. The PC3 contract is nationwide, and it's an outside contract, just like TRICARE has United Healthcare. The VA system has the PC3 contract, CROSS-West, which is the third-party administrator for that program as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you to everyone that testified and the committee members that have attended. I appreciate very much. Obviously, at 1650 South LaGrasse Street at the Chris Kyle Patriots Hospital, we're going to have a celebration. And of that opening, and so without seeing other questions, the House Military and Veterans Affairs Special Committee meeting being held at North Star Hospital has concluded at 10:37. Thank you very much.